Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for June 17th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, toward a treatment for the wasting away syndrome associated with cancer, funding anti-malaria efforts in Africa, and how genomes are illuminating plant evolution. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
One of the most devastating aspects of cancer is the fact that many victims seem to waste away before our eyes. That wasting syndrome has a name, cachexia, and it's the immediate cause of death in 15% of cancer cases overall, and a far higher percentage in certain types of malignancies such as pancreatic cancer. But a paper published online by Science this week casts new light on two important enzymes that appear to mediate cancer-associated cachexia. While the work thus far has been done only in mice, it could point to pharmacological pathways that might ultimately be used to blunt the devastating wasting syndrome in humans. One of the paper's senior authors, Rudolf Zechner, described the work to me speaking by phone from his office at the University of Graz in Austria.
So the main findings was actually that lipolysis is a process of breakdown of fat, that this is an essential process in the pathogenesis of cachexia. So that means without functional lipolysis, without this functional breakdown of fat, some of the hallmarks of cachexia, such as weight loss or loss of adipose tissue and muscle mass, they do not occur.
Well, let's step back a moment. What is cachexia, and what is its role in the pathology of cancer in particular?
Cachexia is a multifactorial disease. It's defined by the uncontrolled loss of body weight, and this loss of body weight cannot be really reversed nutritionally, so it cannot be cured by diet alone. And this weight loss is specifically caused by a loss of adipose tissue and muscle tissue.
Adipose tissue being essentially fat cells.
Exactly.
So what we're talking about here is really this kind of characteristic wasting away that we see in cancer patients. Is that right?
Right. I mean, cachexia is quite common in several chronic diseases, including like certain forms of heart disease or lung disease like COPD. It occurs in infectious diseases like tuberculosis, HIV infections. But it's really most common in patients of cancer. Not all cancer patients. You see it's quite commonly occurring in patients that suffer from cancers in the gastrointestinal tract, like pancreas cancer. For example, in pancreas cancer, it's 85% of the patients are affected by cachexia eventually.
Okay, and in looking at this, in this work, you targeted a specific pair of enzymes in particular as being associated with this syndrome, this wasting syndrome. What pointed you in that direction?
It's been known for quite some time, actually, and that's worked from a Swedish group, Peter Arne and his colleagues, that in cancer patients with cachexia, lipolysis, fat catabolism is upregulated in adipose tissue. So that's been known, and this led to our hypothesis that the enzymes involved in fat catabolism may play a causal role in the development of cachexia. So this was kind of the starting point of our work.
And these enzymes are called ATGL and HSL?
They're called adipose triglyceride lipase, or, you know, abbreviated ATGL, and hormone-sensitive lipase, or HSL.
Okay, just how did you go about investigating the role of these enzymes in cachexia, then, specifically?
What we did is we induced cancer cachexia in mice. But by injecting cancer cells, we actually used two different kinds. One was a lung carcinoma cell line, the other was a melanoma cell line, and we injected those cells into control mice and into mice that either lacked ATGL or HSL, because these two enzymes are actually the major lipases that that degrade fat.
And so you confirmed in the wild-type mice, first of all, that they did show the cachexia syndrome.
Exactly.
And then you essentially, what did you do, compare the loss of tissue in the normal mice with the mutant mice? Is that it?
The initial experiment was just really looking at body weight. And we were very surprised, actually, that, you know, whereas control mice, they lost body weight after 2 or 3 weeks of duration of the experiment, we didn't see any weight loss in the ATGL knockout, and we saw some protection against weight loss in the hormone-sensitive lipase, the HSL knockout. So then we started looking more closely. We looked at loss of adipose tissue and saw kind of the same thing. Absolutely no loss of adipose tissue in ATGL-deficient mice, and partial protection against loss of adipose tissue in the HSL knockout mice. And what was even more surprising then, we saw also protection against loss of muscle mass. This was really unexpected because originally we thought, you know, if you don't have these lipases, well, maybe it could be kind of logical that they don't lose adipose tissue, but that this also protects the mice from loss of muscle mass was really unexpected and surprising. So again, ATGL knockout mice lost no muscle mass. HSL knockout mice were partially protected, and wild-type mice lost 40% of their muscle mass.
So I'm curious, on the specific finding with the muscle mass, what might explain that?
Well, we don't really know. There's a couple of hypotheses out there. You know, at this point, we don't even know is it the deficiency of lipases in adipose tissue that protects these mice from losing muscle mass, or is it deficiency of lipases in the muscle itself, because ATGL is expressed also in muscle that protects these mice. So the mechanism at this point is unknown. What we do know is that proteasomal degradation of muscle protein, this is all inhibited in the ATGL knockout background.
So there may be sort of other effects of this enzyme beyond just the lipid.
Our suspicion is that there's some signaling effect going on, maybe even mediated by lipids, but at this point we don't know.
Okay, well, what are the implications of this work for treatment in human cancer cases?
What's been interesting and what may be relevant for humans is this finding that we also report in this paper, that actually human patients with cachexia have increased lipase activities in their adipose tissue. So both ATGL and HSL are upregulated and differentiate cachectic patients from other patients with weight loss, for example, due to dietary manipulations. So there's obviously something going on which is very similar as we saw in the mouse, that in cachexia you have upregulation of lipases in adipose tissue. So whether these lipases can now be a target for drugs or for potential drugs, we need to know a couple of things that we don't know at this point. One very important issue that needs to be solved now is, can we, by partial inhibition of lipases, by drugs, by small compounds, small molecules, can we have an effect on cachexia? Because our experiments were performed in knockout mice, so these mice lack all ATGL or all HSL. With drugs, you cannot really achieve a 100% inhibition as you can with a gene knockout. So the thing to see is now, does inhibition by drugs also have an effect, or this partial inhibition of lipases have an effect? So that's number one. Number two would be, we still need potent inhibitors. Hormone-sensitive lipase inhibitors are known, but they have never been tested in humans. ATGL inhibitors are lacking altogether. We have no compounds that inhibit this enzyme, so they need to be developed. And then there's another couple of questions of mechanism that we just talked about. We do need to elucidate how does this actually work, this signaling via lipolysis and via lipases.
Rudolf Zechner, thanks very much for being with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Rudolf Zechner is a senior author of a new paper on the role of two lipase enzymes in cancer-associated cachexia. You can find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Since 2002, the archipelago of Zanzibar, lying off the coast of mainland Tanzania, has, through active intervention, dramatically reduced the incidence of malaria, so much so that incidence rates hovered just above zero in some parts of the country. That success has left Zanzibar debating where to go next, and in particular whether its goal should be complete elimination of the disease or an ongoing program of disease control at low levels. The debate mirrors a larger ongoing argument for Africa as a whole. But in a policy forum in this week's Science, David Smith of the University of Florida's Emerging Pathogens Institute, along with six co-authors, notes that Zanzibar has been at this kind of crossroads before, and that Zanzibar's history on the malaria front suggests that the debate between elimination and control strategies misses the point. The real key, say the authors, is making sure that the funding for these efforts is sustained over the long haul. Smith spoke with me about it by phone this week.
The main idea is that we don't want history to repeat itself in Zanzibar. And when I say history, I mean the history of malaria control.
And you, in your article, refer to that history, to the history of malaria control in Zanzibar as a Sisyphean, I believe. What is it about that history that leads you to choose that particular metaphor?
Well, King Sisyphus was the Greek king. Sisyphus made the mistake of tattling on Zeus, and for his indiscretion and treachery, Zeus cursed him, and he was forced to push a large boulder up a hill, but never allowed to reach the crest and rest. Every time he would reach the top of the hill, the boulder would roll to the side and roll back down the hill to the bottom. Sisyphus would have to try again to get the boulder up the hill. Now, the metaphor here for Zanzibar is that there have been at least two other occasions when Zanzibar has managed to knock malaria down, and in one case, knock it down very low. So to put us in the present context, today, Zanzibar has very little malaria. They're on the point of being able to do something remarkable, and that is to nearly eliminate malaria. Every time they've reached this point in the past, they had knocked malaria way down, but the money ran out, and malaria came roaring back. By the end of the 1970s, they recognized that malaria was a problem again, and the USAID and the Zanzibar Malaria Control Program jointly organized another round of interventions, intensive interventions that lasted through the 80s, until that money ran out, and then they left, and malaria came. Well, we presume it came back to its former levels.
And now you noted that they've once again, through a great deal of effort, reduced malaria incidence. Is the rock about to roll down the hill again?
Well, we sure hope not. One of the reasons why people think it's okay to stop distributing these bed nets or spraying or whatever they did to knock malaria down is that once malaria has gone away, it's not there reminding you all the time that it's there. It's a perpetual threat in places like Zanzibar. And I think the sort of the fact that when you've removed the interventions and malaria has come back in the past, that's good enough evidence that it will come back in the future. Part of the problem here is that once it's gone, once people are not seeing deaths from malaria in Zanzibar, they assume that it's a job done and they can move on and go spend the money on something else. If they do that, of course, malaria will come back. And so what we're really arguing is that people need to recognize two things. One is that there has been a major achievement in Zanzibar, and we're saving thousands of lives each year. It's a really good bargain in global health. I mean, if you knew that you could save a life for just a little over $1,000 a year, I think you would think that was a really good deal. And that's the approximate return on investment that we're getting. The problem is, though, that as long as you're not seeing the malaria deaths coming through, you're tempted to believe the same thing you believe about, say, malaria in Alaska. And this has always been the problem with prevention, is that in many places, without seeing the costs, you can't really make the case for prevention. You can always make the case for cure, but you can't make the case for prevention. And it gets harder and harder to make the case for prevention once malaria is gone, even though now we have the third time to prove there is a real risk that malaria will come back if we don't keep up the intervention. But, you know, there are a lot of needs in Africa. It's not just Zanzibar that needs this level of intervention. It's the rest of Africa as well.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I guess struck me about your article is that it seems that these eradication efforts are left to individual countries, but it doesn't seem like malaria really knows much about national boundaries.
Of course not. Most infectious diseases cross boundaries. In some sense, the more you can coordinate and do a good job in controlling in one country, the more there's a benefit. We got involved with this analysis in Zanzibar in the first place because Zanzibar had made so much progress. And now the open question for Zanzibar was, what next? What comes next? Should we eliminate malaria, that is to say, get rid of it, and then adopt a new strategy of doing something like outbreak control based around individual imported cases? Or should we just keep up the current interventions that we have and minimize the burden of malaria, keep it really, really low? And everybody that we talked to, and you know, we were advised by a lot of very smart people, said that was the kind of analysis that we needed to do. to think about these two options of what are called control and elimination. Elimination is getting rid of it, and control is knocking it down to very low levels, but not worrying if you've gotten rid of it. And so that was our mindset. We were going to go in there and figure out which of these was the better option. And then we went in and we did our analysis and we did a lot of thinking about it. And then we came to this question at the end and we started thinking, well, you know, what is the real difference between control or elimination? That is to say, if we got rid of it, we still have to deal with imported malaria. There's still going to be a risk. And if we don't get rid of it, then we obviously have to worry about the risk of it returning. And we started to think in very different terms and realized that the real issue for Zanzibar was not whether control or elimination was the best way to move forward. It was how they were going to manage to sustain funding for as long as malaria was a risk. And we don't know how long that is. Obviously, if it's part of a coordinated effort in Africa and Greater Africa, then at some point you could stop spending money because the risk would eventually disappear. But if that's not possible, and certainly for the next feasible future, the risk will remain. There has to be some way of guaranteeing spending for Zanzibar. And if Zanzibar can't do it, then no place can, right? And this is the issue that we found to be so compelling, is that Zanzibar has made such great progress that for them to lose traction and lose malaria control now would be a major setback for all of Africa, because this is one of the places that's done so well. And so we need to show that it's possible to do something and come up with a coherent plan, one that proves that there can be some kind of continuity in funding.
So what would the elements of such a plan be? Are there practical suggestions for ways to break this cycle?
Well, the one that suggested itself to us came out of our analysis. And that was that if you started to import less malaria, and most of the malaria we believe is being imported from Dar es Salaam and from coastal Kenya and coastal Tanzania, places where the fishing boats go between Zanzibar and the mainland and on the ferry. And if you could take care of that traffic in malaria, the imported malaria that was coming across, then you could actually start spending a lot less money in Zanzibar and still manage the risk reasonably well. And so this leads to a kind of a progressive strategy where Zanzibar would be sort of at one end of it, and the next thing you take care of is the next places, the places that are next to it. So you come up with a strategy of dealing with it on the coast in Dar es Salaam, and then you sort of create a malaria-free zone, and you just keep moving that zone into the heart of Africa until pretty soon Zanzibar is so far away from any place with malaria that its risk is negligible. The main idea, though, is that when we did the analysis, we realized that Zanzibar would spend a lot less if its neighbors did a good job of controlling malaria. And if those places would control malaria, then Zanzibar's costs would be reduced. So in some sense, the best thing to do for Zanzibar now is to just maintain the course, but expand the effort and try to build the success out from Zanzibar into neighboring Africa and keep that movement going as a kind of a traveling wave into the heart of Africa. And if we could do that, then eventually Zanzibar's costs would go down, coastal Kenya and Tanzania's costs would go down, and eventually you could start to scale back the expenditures without really increasing the risk.
But whatever the strategy is in the long term, right now you have to keep the money flowing to make any of this work.
You have to keep the funding sustained or none of this makes any sense at all. And that's the biggest point, right? That we really have to keep the money flowing in, and we have to keep enough money flowing in so that we don't play this game of whack-a-mole. So we've controlled it in Zanzibar, so we take the money away from Zanzibar and we give it to someplace else. And they control malaria, and then malaria comes back to Zanzibar, and we go back, oh, malaria's come back. Wow, that's shocking. The debate about control or elimination has not been productive. I came away from Zanzibar with a very optimistic outlook on malaria in Africa. And I think that the main message we need to be sending to funders is that you can do something about malaria in Africa if you spend enough money for long enough, that you can actually achieve something great. And I think that is the main message we wanted to send to the funders mainly, but also to people in the malaria community, that it's time to sort of put aside these debates about the small issues and focus on the big one. And the big one is that we need enough money to be coming into Africa to actually get the job done.
David Smith, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Smith is the lead author of a Policy Forum article in this week's Science on the importance of sustained funding in efforts to fight malaria in Zanzibar and the rest of Africa. This week, a news focus by Science's Liz Panisi looks at some of the significant new insights being unearthed from plant genomes. Here's Liz Panisi.
So this story is about how plant genomes have led to a better understanding of plant evolution.
And I think in the story you note right now that only about 30 plant genomes have been sequenced. I assume that compares sort of unfavorably with a number of animal genomes. What kinds of plants have been the focus thus far?
The focus so far have been angiosperms, which are the flowering plants. That includes corn, poplar, grape, strawberries, plants that have flowers and produce seeds. In addition to that, there have been a few plants from other groups that have been sequenced, a moss, an algae, most recently something called a spike moss, which is a lycophyte, a vascular plant, which means it has water and nutrient conducting tissues and can grow tall. It's possible to grow tall, but it does not produce seeds.
So in a sense, this might be viewed as sort of a transitional form between the moss that's been sequenced and maybe the other plants that
exactly,
have been sequenced.
Exactly.
Well, even this selection, this small selection of plants seems to be, if I'm reading your story correctly, telling us a lot about plant evolution. What are some of the things that have come out of this?
Well, one of the things that's come out of this is that genes have very deep roots. So genes that are involved in, say, the production of seeds or the development of flowers are found in some form or another all the way down into the mosses. They obviously don't make flowers in moss, but they're there in the moss for some other purpose.
So they're being repurposed to make the flowers.
That's right. They're being repurposed. So, for example, the spike moss is a small green plant with scale-like leaves, and yet it has genes for woodiness in it that are later used for wood production in larger plants.
And this is certainly not, we're certainly not talking about a tree here.
No, not now. I mean, there was a time in 300 million years ago when a different set of lycophytes existed on Earth, and they were the trees of the Carboniferous forests. But nowadays, they're just these small, tiny plants.
Well, one of the scientists you interviewed said that plants practice a sort of genomic anarchy, which is a phrase I kind of liked. What does that mean exactly?
It refers to the fact that plants undergo genome doubling in their history, so they can go through periods where they have twice as many chromosomes and twice as many genes and can tolerate that. It's very hard for an animal genome to tolerate that. They also have more mobile elements in the genome that hop around and create chaos in some sense, but also create new regulatory regions. They have chimeric genes, genes that are like sort of two genes smushed together. They have more of these than in animals and seem to be able to tolerate these better.
Are there other reasons, though, that plants seem to be so dynamic besides just their tolerance? I mean, they almost seem to be constantly experimenting with their genomes. Why is that?
That's a good question. We don't really know why they've experimented with their genomes. But if you think about the way a plant lives and the way it survives, a seed grows and it's sort of stuck in one place and it has to sort of defend itself against the environment, against pathogens, any way it can. It can't get up and move away. So one way to explore new ways of defending yourself is to allow genes to be flexible, allow more genes to come on board, new genes to come on board and allow genes to have new ways to be regulated. And that creates proteins that maybe have a better way of fighting off an infection or a better way of coping with the environment.
Well, obviously, with only 30 genomes sequenced, there's lots of room for others. What do plant scientists see as some of the big holes to be filled at this point?
Well, there are a couple of major groups of plants that we still don't have genomes for. One of them are the gymnosperms, which includes the conifers, and another one is the ferns. We don't have any plant genomes from ferns.
And are there projects underway to fill these holes?
Well, actually, there's a new project in the U.S. where funding has been approved for the sequencing of three conifer genomes. There's the loblolly pine, the sugar pine, and the Douglas fir. And then there's another project elsewhere for the sequencing of the Norway spruce. So within a couple of years, we should have genome sequences of four gymnosperms.
Well, Liz Panisi, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Liz Panisi writes about how plant genomes are leading to a better understanding of plant evolution in a news focus in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with some stories that have shown up lately on our daily news site. Okay, David, in the first story, a cell becomes a laser. Now, how does that happen?
Well, this is a really interesting story because for the 50 years or so that lasers have been around, they've always been based on inanimate materials, solids, liquids, or gases, never anything biological. So what's really cool about this study is this is the first, according to the researchers, biological laser.
Well, what is a biological laser?
Well, the way a traditional laser works is basically by pumping atoms or molecules in a gas or a liquid or solid into a more energetic state, getting them more excited. And you usually do this with electricity or sometimes chemically or even sometimes with another laser. And what happens is once these atoms, say, get pumped up and they get very excited, they eventually decay and they emit a photon. And this photon will begin tipping the other atoms from their excited states and releases this torrent of new photons. And it's sort of this snowball effect. And these photons essentially keep on amplifying themselves. They bounce back and forth between two mirrors. And eventually some of the light gets out in a characteristically focused beam, sort of what you think of when you think of a laser. Anyways, that's how it traditionally works. And what scientists wanted to do in this new study was figure out, can we replicate this on a cellular level? Can we make a cell basically do the same thing that a laser does?
And so cells, I know, have expressed, you know, green fluorescent proteins. And is that part of this story?
That is. And it's exactly green fluorescent protein, also known as GFP. Scientists call it for short. This was a protein that was isolated from jellyfish in the early 1960s. And as you alluded to, Stuart, it makes cells glow green. The other really cool thing about GFP is it can be inserted into practically any cell. And scientists use it to study how proteins move around in cells, to do a variety of other things. It's a really nice sort of tracer protein. And this new study, scientists said, well, you know, we've already got this protein that's emitting light. It's emitting green light. Can we sort of focus it and amplify it so it becomes more like a laser beam? So they took human kidney cells, which normally don't express GFP, and they inserted GFP into them. And then they tried to replicate sort of what happens with a laser. And what they did was they took a couple cells that expressed GFP. And with one of these cells, they pumped it with another laser. This laser emitted blue light. And this was, again, a way to get the photons in the GFP excited. And normally the blue light would simply make the GFP in that cell fluoresce and glow green. But what they did was they put these couple cells inside a very tight cavity, and that this cavity also had mirrors in it, just like a laser would. And what happened was when this one cell was excited, it bounced back and forth between the two cells, amplifying the emission until the researchers saw a green beam, just like you might see. Well, maybe not just like you would see from a normal laser, but essentially the same idea you would see from a laser.
Well, it sounds pretty cool, but it's kind of hard to know what the application would be.
Right. It's cool. And the question is, where do they go from here? And the scientists actually have a number of ideas. There's a lot of thinking about using lasers to kill cancer cells in the body. But obviously, if you're using a big laser, that can be very destructive. But if you can make the lasers very small and put them in cells that are actually in the body anyways, it might be useful for a way to better target cancer cells.
Sort of cell-based laser surgery.
Exactly. Also, some other applications that have nothing to do with cancer. There's a lot of work right now about developing human biological interfaces, ways for people that are quote-unquote locked in, people that have no way of communicating with the outside world, either because they can't speak or they can't move any parts of their body, but may still be able to use their mind. It's possible that a biological laser-based system might allow people in wheelchairs that are locked in to manipulate their wheelchair, to even communicate on keyboards. And one of the coolest applications the scientists have in mind is this idea of self-healing lasers. All the lasers we have today are all mechanical, and mechanics break down, but cells can be regenerated. So the idea is, if you have a laser made of cells versus lasers made of mechanical parts, you may be able to create lasers that can repair themselves, which would be pretty cool.
And next, going Pandora one better, something about predicting music sales and preferences through brain scans.
Well, right, Stuart. The study came about, in a very interesting way. A couple years ago, a scientist named Gregory Burns, who's a neuroeconomist at Emory University in Atlanta, was sitting on the couch with his kids, and he was watching American Idol, which is a very popular show in the U.S. where contestants try to out-sing each other. And one of the contestants was singing a song called Apologize, which is by a group called One Republic. And when the song aired, something clicked in Burns' mind. He said, you know what? I remember using this song in one of my studies. A couple of years ago, he was studying students in his lab, and he was basically trying to figure out how kids respond to peer pressure when they pick their musical choices. Do they just decide they like songs because they inherently like them, or do they decide they like a song because they've been told that their peers like the song as well? And as part of the study, these teenagers listened to about 100 odd songs, and they had their brains scanned while they were listening to the songs to sort of figure out what was going on in their brains. Well, it turns out a lot of the songs, in fact, most of the songs that were played for these kids were very obscure songs that the researchers found on MySpace and other sites, songs they wouldn't have heard before, songs by groups that really hadn't been signed. And in this new study, Byrne said, well, you know what? I wonder if any of those songs have become popular in the past couple of years. And if they have, I wonder if any of that brain scan data we had would have predicted whether these songs would have become popular or
and
not.
And it did.
And it did. Amazingly, it did. What the researchers found is when they correlated the brain scan data they had taken a couple years ago with data from Nielsen SoundScan, which is basically a service that tracks music sales, they saw a correlation in activity in the nucleus accumbens of the brain, which is a region of the brain that's linked to reward and anticipation. And basically, the higher the activity in this region of the brain, the more likely a song was to become popular. Now, it wasn't a perfect correlation. The nucleus accumbens only accounted for about a 10% variance in song sales, but it was still a correlation.
Does that mean that music companies are going to start scanning people's brains?
Well, it's a really interesting question. There's actually a field called neuromarketing where some companies are actually trying to see whether they can predict consumer preference just by brain scan. Because one of the interesting things the researchers found in this study, besides the fact that they saw this correlation, was that this correlation was actually stronger than what the kids said their musical preferences were. So if the kids said, hey, I really like song X, chances are song X wouldn't tend to be the song that actually became popular. But if their brains said, hey, you really seem to be liking song X, that was far more predictive. And so for neuromarketers, they might be really interested in this data. Though, as one expert points out, this is really preliminary stuff, and he wouldn't invest in any company right now that was going to use this data. He says it's just way too preliminary. So something to look out for, but it's not going to change the world of consumer preferences just yet.
Okay, I won't change my portfolio.
Right.
Finally, a magnetic alternative to cardiovascular medicines. What's that all about?
Right, Stuart, well, this last story is about using magnets to help try to prevent stroke. And one of the leading causes of strokes and heart attacks, which is actually one of the leading causes of death in the industrialized world, is blood viscosity, meaning basically the thicker your blood is, the more likely you are to have a stroke and a heart attack. And that's because thicker blood tends to damage blood vessels. And when the body tries to repair the damage, the vessels build up fatty deposits, which makes strokes and heart attacks more likely. Now,
and that's why aspirin is given for these conditions, correct?
Exactly. Aspirin is very highly prescribed for this because aspirin thins the blood. But aspirin has side effects. In high doses, it can cause stomach bleeding, ulcers, or even tinnitus, which is a ringing of the ears. So in this new study, scientists are trying to figure out, is there a safer alternative to aspirin? And they hit upon magnets. Now, magnets are already used in medicine. If you've ever gotten an MRI, magnets of strengths of 1 to 3 Tesla are already used. And as far as researchers can tell, these magnets don't have any side effects. So they're pretty safe. And so the researchers in this study said, well, what if we used a magnet that emits about 1 Tesla and we apply it to a blood sample? Can we change the viscosity? And in fact, they found they could. When they put this blood sample in the lab under this magnetic force for about a minute, the viscosity reduced by about 20 to 30%.
That's a pretty big effect. How's it working?
Well, they're pretty sure it has to do with hemoglobin, which is this iron-based protein in red blood cells. They think basically that in the same way that iron fillings would align themselves along the field lines of a bar magnet, so too do red blood cells align themselves along the field lines of the magnet that was used in this study. And this reduces viscosity in a couple ways. First of all, the cells all start to sort of point in the same direction, or at least the direction of the flow. So they're not sort of going in different directions, which would increase viscosity. They're all sort of flowing very nicely. Also, the researchers think that this alignment actually helps the cells stick together. Now, you might think that actually increases viscosity, but when cells form these small clumps, these clumps actually have less surface area than individual cells themselves, which actually makes the blood less viscous.
So is there any disadvantages of doing it this way?
Well, one disadvantage is, or at least one challenge is, that the blood that's being subjected to the magnet must all be flowing in the same direction. So you couldn't just put a magnet on somebody's whole body because you've got all these vessels and capillaries that are running in various different directions. But the researchers say that you may not need to do that. If you just focus the magnet on one particular, say, vein or artery that was running in one direction, even if you did it for a short period of time, the effect would be transmitted to the rest of the body because if you're decreasing the viscosity in one localized area, that blood is getting pumped to the rest of the body where it still maintains that low viscosity. And after a short period of time, theoretically, most of the blood in the body viscosity would be reduced as well. But it's important to note this is very preliminary. It's a very interesting and exciting idea, but the researchers have just tested this on blood in basically a vial in the lab. They have not even gone into animal studies yet. So it's a promising idea, but still, a lot of work needs to be done.
Okay, David, what other stories are you looking at for the news site this week?
Well, Stuart, we've got a story for Science Now about why female finches cheat, and it may have to do with a promiscuity gene that is passed.
A promiscuity gene.
Exactly. It's passed from parents to offspring. Also, a story about a mysterious gamma ray burst that's been detected and how it may be linked to a black hole eating a star. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about death threats that are being fielded against Australian climate scientists, and also a story about how U.S. President Barack Obama is under fire for canceling a planned nuclear waste facility in Nevada. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week we've got a chat about the dangers, or perhaps lack thereof, of cell phone use. We're going to have a couple experts on that will answer all of your questions about what the latest scientific studies say about how harmful, or perhaps how not harmful, cell phones are. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the June 17th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast. Thanks to Andrew Green for help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.